listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to www.nakedbibleblog.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 53, question and answer number 3. I'm your layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Very good. Hope you're doing well, Trey.
I'm doing pretty good. Well, this episode, we have about 8 questions thereabouts, so that's pretty exciting. I just want to remind everybody who sent in your questions last week and this week, I'm saving those, so please continue to send me your questions. We probably have enough questions for another 1 or 2 shows, so we'll certainly get to them in time. So feel free to email me at treystrickland@gmail.com. You can get that email on the website, nakedbiblepodcast.com. And with that, Mike, do you just want to jump into these questions?
Sure, let's just get it going.
Okay, well, the first one's from Mike. And with all of the books on Revelation, what are some good textually accurate sources for study you might suggest? He finds it difficult to find books that don't lock into a single view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's pretty normal. I presume by textually accurate that the questioner means something that engages the original text. In other words, something that sticks to the original text, not just the translation. If he's talking about textual criticism stuff, you know, what the right text is, part of what I'll answer here, we'll deal with that. But I'm assuming that he means commentaries that engage the original text as opposed to English. And, you know, I'm sympathetic here because it's basically impossible to find a commentary on Revelation that doesn't take or at least favor one particular eschatological view. So my advice on a question like this is always have more than one, and have more than one that is seriously engaging, again, the original text. So you have to realize interpreting Revelation is driven by presuppositions, and nobody can really sort of avoid that. And so you can have various commentators, various scholars engage the text real seriously and come out at different places because, again, where you come out in Revelation is really driven by presuppositions. Is there a hard and fast distinction between Israel and the church, for instance? That's one of them. Or how should we interpret Old Testament prophecy? Do we have this idea of sort of rigid literalism, one-to-one correspondences, or don't we? You know, questions like that. When was the book written? Is it pre-70 AD or is it after 70 AD? And none of those things are self-evident on the surface. And so scholars have had to make decisions about the text before they even look at it, before they even get there. And so that's why you can have serious people come out at different places when it comes to interpreting the book of Revelation, often more so than practically any other book. Here's one of them. Should I read the book in as a linear chronology of events, or should I read it as a series of events that get repeated 4 or 5 times throughout the book in different language? Again, depending on how you answer that question, how you think, what you think the right answer is there, you're going to come out with totally different end times scenes or end times scenarios. So before you even get into the nuts and bolts of exegesis, you have these higher level presuppositional things to deal with. Now, with that in mind, again, telling you know, listeners and Mike to have more than one. My preference here, even though I'm not where this guy's at eschatologically, at least not totally. I mean, I've said before, I don't like any of the views, any of the systems, I should say, of eschatology, because they all are on target on some things, and they're all, I think, off target on some things. They all have something to contribute, but I don't feel compelled to follow any of them. So when I recommend my first choice here, it would be Greg Beale's New International Greek Text Commentary. Again, this is a massive Revelation commentary. I think it's like 1,200 pages. It's a huge volume. And you have to have some facility in Greek to even use this at all, because the Greek is not transliterated. It's going to be Greek text in it. What's great about Beale, though, even if you don't have Greek, okay, what's great about his commentary that distances it from any other commentary on Revelation is that he has thoroughly engaged the Second Temple Jewish literature. In other words, the intertestamental Jewish literature leading up to the New Testament and up to the writing of the book of Revelation. So all of that stuff in, you know, apocryphal literature, pseudepigrapha like Enoch or Jubilees or the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs or whatever, Qumran material, Beale has been through all of it. And where it can be brought to bear on analysis, he makes an attempt to do that. So Beale teaches at Wheaton. I think he's actually in the New Testament department. Most of his work has been on the relationship of the New Testament and the Old Testament. So this is sort of his bread and butter, you know, this kind of analysis, really taking Second Temple literature seriously and trying to, again, to bring it to bear on the book of Revelation. So even if you don't, you know, you can't read the Greek that's thrown in there, he'll discuss lots of other texts, again, from this period, the way, you know, Jewish thinkers, Jewish writers were thinking about, you know, things that get discussed in the book of Revelation, you know, themes and motifs and, you know, phrases and all the way back into Daniel and other stuff that's like Daniel and Enoch and all that kind of stuff. So Beale is worth having just for that reason alone. Beale is, he describes himself as an idealist amillennialist. So he's not, you know, he's not going to believe in a rapture or anything like this. He's going to be, you know, obviously affirm the second coming. He's not a full preterist or anything like that. So, you know, he'll tell you what he is when he discusses in sort of an introduction, he discusses, you know, the different approaches to the book, and he tells you where he's at. But he's definitely worth having, again, just because of the grunt work that he's done. If you want something that is pretty much dyed in the wool, pre-trib, premillennial rapture kind of position, probably the best you can do here is Bob Thomas's book, Robert Thomas. I think it's published by Moody. And I also think it's two volumes on the book of Revelation, but it's pretty much straight down the line, pre-trib, pre-mill, rapture kind of stuff. Thomas rarely engages Second Temple literature or anything like that, which I view as deeply flawed. But again, if you're looking sort of for a defense of that view that has some exegetical grounding, I don't know that you can do better than Thomas. For years, the old standard was John Walvoord's book, Commentary on Revelation, but Thomas's far exceeds that in sort of textual level detail, you know, that kind of thing. So I think if you had both of those, and you know, unless you're really just turned off by the pre-trib, pre-mill view, then you wouldn't necessarily bother with Thomas. You could probably just get by with Beale, or maybe something in the New International Commentary series or the New American Commentary series. That's actually a sort of a Southern Baptist publication or a series, and so I'm not sure that that's pre-trib, pre-mill. It might be, but it's probably going to be at least be pre-millennial. Yeah, the New American Commentary series, whoever did that volume, but series like that, New International Commentary, New American Commentary, Word Biblical Commentary. Dave, that's actually in three volumes. David Aune, A-U-N-E. That one is not going to be pre-trib, pre-mill. It's also going to be very deeply informed by Second Temple literature, Greco-Roman stuff. That's very much worth getting. But that one, too, it's going to be like Beale. You have to be able to read some things in Greek because it's not transliterated. New International, it will be. New American Commentary, the Greek will be transliterated into English characters. But there are some good ones. But if you're looking for something that doesn't take a view, good luck with that. You're just not going to find it. What you could do is there's a book. Zondervan puts it out on the Book of Revelation, Four Views. Zondervan has this Four Views series. And so it will give you overviews and defenses of four particular approaches. And then the other three writers in the book respond to each of the other positions that they don't hold. So it's kind of an interactive discussion. So if you wanted something that sort of can take you down all the roads, but it's not actually a commentary, that would be a good choice. So Revelation Four Views is a book you can get.
Our next question is from Corey. What is the clearest understanding of the appropriate use of force to defend oneself or family that harmonizes scenarios from the Old Testament up through the early church and how it relates to or differs from the threat of harm for simply being Christian?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I don't know of any command that makes self-defense a sin. Even self-defense by the use of force is sin. I mean, people probably would think of the turn the other cheek passage. You know, the context for that is largely, again, self-preservation. And I think you know you can take that choice. But what I'm trying to say is that any kind of self-defense doesn't have to be a sort of first resort. And so I look at the turn the other cheek command as leaving the door open to not defending yourself at all, or at the very least not having it be sort of a reflex, you know, first response, you know, kind of thing. But when it pertains to other people, the text doesn't say turn everybody else's cheek, you know, especially, you know, if it's someone, you know, in your family, someone that you have, you know, there's the whole biblical principle of when it's in your power to do good for someone, you ought to do it. You know, from the book of James, you know, that I would suggest that saving somebody's life is probably a good thing to do for them. And, you know, if that requires the use of force, then I don't see anything that forbids that. So that I don't see the turn the other cheek thing as sort of this cut and dried, no nuancing possible sort of statement. I think there is some nuancing there. You know, I don't know of any principle that says, you know, Christians must be willing to be abused in at all times, places, and manners as well. What I think the point of the command is that you're not combative, you're not the aggressor, you know, you're not, this isn't a first response, you know, kind of thing. You're not looking for a fight, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, what Jesus did say, and I think this command largely gets misunderstood. You know, I've not come to bring peace. I've come to bring a sword. Or, you know, and he tells them, the disciples at one point, to go out and, you know, take a sword with them. Those are not offensive weapon sort of endorsements. In other words, Jesus isn't saying, "Well, I'm here to pick a fight," you know, and I want you guys to go out and pick fights as well. The whole idea behind those things is that Jesus knew that when he came and when he started preaching who he was, and he knew where it was going to lead. He knew it would result in, you know, upheaval and persecution. He knew the early church was going to be targeted. And so he actually advocates in those examples having something with you to defend yourself. But what I don't want to see is, I don't want to see statements like that taken out of context as far as, oh, now we get to, this is our first response. You know, somebody comes after us because we're Christians, we're going to go beat the crap out of them. You know, that isn't the point at all. It's a very defensive posture. It's not the first response. Again, and these things do have a context, and I don't think that the point of them is either be the aggressor or, you know, be the doormat, you know, unto death. I mean, if it's just you, I mean, you can make that decision. I don't think you're committing suicide, you know, necessarily or something like that. But I certainly think there is good reason to believe, again, from the Gospels and some of the statements, you know, I've just alluded to, that you are allowed to defend yourself. I mean, you think back into the Old Testament. I mean, God, there are plenty of examples where God expected his people to defend themselves, you know, against their enemies, you know, when they were threatened with attack or serious bodily harm or death. I mean, you're not forbidden from building fences. You're not forbidden from having standing armies. You're not forbidden. I mean, you even have the Avenger of Blood kind of thing, which is a little bit different. But again, it's this notion that God isn't repulsed by using physical force for some appropriate purpose. So the idea of physical force itself is not repugnant to God. So I think the point of a lot of this language is, again, it can't be used to support aggression or, again, a first response kind of reaction, as opposed to defending yourself as kind of a last resort or, again, to protect others. I think another problem is that Christians somehow think the use of force might be okay for less than severe bodily threat. Again, when I think of use of force and when I see it discussed in Scripture, it's not just a defense against, oh, my city government made another regulation and I don't like it, so I'm going to go down there and, you know, again, beat the tar out of somebody, or I'm going to threaten their family, you know, and say, you can't do that. This is a terrible law. This is persecuting, you know, my church. So I'm going to go threaten you with bodily harm. I mean, this is absurd, but I mention it because we do have some of this thinking in the church. You know, the church has somehow been conflated with the Sons of Liberty or something, you know, in the revolutionary period. You know, that we're being oppressed by the king, so let's go, you know, burn somebody's house down or destroy their property or something like that. Again, these are absurd conflations, and I do see them in places in the church. We have to see them for what they are. They're conflating two different things. They're combining two different things that shouldn't be combined. So I think we have to guard against that. What I'm talking about, what I think of the intent of the question is this situation where you have severe bodily harm, perhaps, you know, threat of death, you know, kind of thing, can you defend yourself? And I think, yeah, you can certainly defend yourself. I mean, this whole idea about authority, you know, Romans 13, we're quick to quote that, but Romans 13, of course, presupposes that the government is doing good things. It's, you know, punishing the wicked and rewarding the person who's obedient. We often aren't in those situations, and I'm not going to say that I'm not going to contradict Paul and say those powers that be aren't really ordained by God. I think they are ordained by God. No government authority. I mean, just let's go back and think about the book of Daniel, you know, because Daniel actually has these discussions when he's interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's dream. No governing authority gets to where it is unless God allows it. God sets up kings and he tears them down. So it's true that every governing authority is where it is because God has allowed that. But that doesn't mean that God endorses it. He doesn't mean he's happy with it. It doesn't even mean that it's not under wrath. Okay, in the Old Testament, yeah, God used Assyria. He used Babylon to punish his own people. But they were also under wrath. I mean, their judgment was pending, and it was going to be even worse than, you know, what he was using them for. So I think, again, we need to contextualize Romans 13 a little bit. I mean, the apostles themselves said we ought to obey God rather than man. You know, you go back in the Old Testament, you have the Egyptian midwives. You know, they were blessed by God because they didn't kill the babies. You know, Daniel's friends, they didn't bow down, you know, to the image of Nebuchadnezzar. And they were, you know, the Lord saved them when you know, their own lives were in peril. Obadiah, he's sort of a forgotten figure, not the one that the prophetic book's named after, but during the time of Elijah, Obadiah was the guy who hid the prophets of the Lord from under, you know, right under Ahab's nose. Okay, God rewarded him for that. These are all resistances to governing authority. And what I'm saying is they're not contradictory to Romans 13. I mean, the rule of thumb is when a governing authority mandates or tries to force you to sin against the higher authority, the highest authority, which would be God, you're under no obligation to obey that. I'm sorry, Lord, I had to go worship Baal because the king said so. That's not acceptable. You know, God isn't going to say, oh, well, I'll give you a pass for that one. You know, no, that's not acceptable. And so I do think in Scripture we have a principle that there is a time when Christians are not only allowed to resist, you know, that sort of authority, but they're sort of expected to resist that authority. And you might be in a context where you can defend yourself. A lot of these contexts, of course, you can't. And you should be willing, again, to suffer if you're suffering for the right things, as you know, Peter so often said in his writings, because Jesus suffered. But you may also run into contexts where you can protect yourself. And again, I see glimpses of this in the Gospels where Jesus warns his followers that this is what it's going to come to. So take a sword with you, you know, be able to defend yourself, to fight off your enemies. You know, he didn't just go out and say, you know, when somebody comes at you with a sword, just lay down there and say, where do you know, stab me somewhere, make it quick, you know, that kind of thing. We don't see that. But we never see the use of a sword, or again, the use of force as a first response, or in an aggressive mode where something, you know, less than, you know, life and limb is at stake. So I think you can look at scriptural examples and put together, you know, a picture of you know, how it's appropriate to respond in certain situations. You know, we can sit here and theorize and do the philosophizing about how it's best to stay out of harm's way. And I think, sure, that's good, but you're not always going to be able to do that. So, you know, I used to tell my kids, you know, and they're older now. I mean, they're basically grown, but I would still tell them, look, I want you to know that if there's a guy coming through the room or through the window into your room and you start yelling and dad comes into the room and he's trying to get you, I want you to know that dad will kill that guy before he lets him take you. I want you to know that your life is more important than that guy's life. You know, that I won't stop and say, oh, you know, I could probably protect my daughter here if I killed this guy, but I can't figure out a way to do it. Oh, well, you know, it's just too bad. It's just too bad. You know, I wish I could have found a less violent way to protect my kids. I'm not, you know, I wanted my kids to know that dad was their defender and he would do whatever it took. And again, I think we're obligated, you know, to do that in extreme circumstances, because if it's in the power of your hand to do good, that I think is a pretty easy definition of doing good, not allowing my daughter to get abducted. That would be good to her. I'm going to do it. So that's how I think about that whole subject. I know that was a little bit of round robin, you know, kind of thing, but hopefully in there you found an answer, or at least, you know, some direction.
Well, Mike, when you're defending, I mean, are you going full-blown MMA or old-school boxer? I mean, what's Mike?
I'm doing whatever is necessary to disable the person as fast as possible.
Okay. All right. The next question is from Slash, and he says, in Acts, we have visions, dreams, and appearances of messengers or Jesus. In the Bible Study magazine, we have Beth Moore, who claims God has personally shown her via direct revelation, quote, visions. Slash also gets Voice of the Martyr magazine, and he's read of Muslims coming to salvation by direct revelation of the appearance of Christ, who states, he is the way, other testimony through dreams, and lastly, he's got a personal messenger by dream, vision, and appearance declaring Christ as Messiah. As good as the salvation stories sound today, he doesn't see them as possible for today, not that God can't. And Beth Moore, her visions are new revelation. Can you help his understanding of all of this?
Well, I don't see how you could not see them as possible, and then in the same sort of breath turn around and say you can't say God can't. Okay, if you can't say God can't, then he can. And therefore it would be possible for today. So that, I don't know if that's just not worded really well, because it is sort of mutually contradictory there. And that actually reflects my own thoughts on this. So the short answer is God, or Jesus, can basically do what he wants. He can do what he wants to guide people. I try not to put the words God and can't into too many sentences. I mean, there are some that I could think of that I could do that, but I try not to put them into too many sentences. I think God is free to do what he wants, to communicate what he wants communicated at any given point. If he does that, he's not going to contradict this thing that he spent, you know, literally centuries using people to record and preserve for us, namely this thing we call the Bible. He's not going to be in the business of, well, you know, I spent all that time producing that Bible thing, but now I'm going to give Joe Schmo over here a vision that contradicts that totally. We'll just see what he does with that. I mean, God isn't impish. Okay, he's not going to be self-contradictory. The messaging is going to be consistent. Now, what I hear in this question, again, and I'll be honest, what I feel in a lot of this is this notion of sort of opening Pandora's box, you know, like, well, everybody has visions, and everybody can just sort of say, God led me to do X, Y, Z, and all that other stuff. You know, and I'm real sensitive to that because I have a very low view of that kind of thing. I would say, longer answer, I can't really think of a scriptural passage I could produce and actually, you know, whip it out to God and tell God he's violated his own word by sending a messenger to someone or appearing to someone. However, I think the line that needs to be drawn is that binding revelation, okay, that's a key thought, binding revelation on the entire church is no longer happening today. Apostolic authority ended with the 12, the original 12 disciples. Even when they had to replace Judas, it was always, hey, is there somebody here who's been with us from the very beginning, you know, who, you know, walked around with us and listened to the Lord? And there's always this connection to incarnation, the period of incarnation. And that ended when the last of those people, John, as far as we know, the last of them died. I mean, you'll see the word apostle used elsewhere in the New Testament. It just means people who are sent, you know, whether they're missionaries or pastors or whatever, that kind of thing. But then even the apostles, this collective, they're still the 12 that are singled out because they were different. And the reason they were different is because they lived, you know, and listened and were taught by Jesus himself. Even Paul, I mean, Paul sort of refers to himself as one born out of due time. When he defends his apostleship, that is always the basis. The Lord came to me, the Lord appeared to me, the Lord taught me personally, you know, over the course of, you know, X number of years. I mean, he has to connect what he's saying with the incarnation. There was this non-negotiable sense that was the crucial element. We don't have that today. So, frankly, I'm not listening to anybody that claims to have received any binding revelation for me in one of their dreams, okay, or you know, in some experience or whatnot. I'm not going to say God can't do that for the individual, provide some direction. But as soon as that individual starts pretending to be an apostle or, you know, pretending to be some prophetic figure with binding information for all believers everywhere, you know, that's how we would view the Bible. Okay, I think there's no scriptural basis for that at all. Again, apostolic authority ended with the 12, you know, Old Testament prophets and apostles. They, you know, they had these sorts of visitations. Again, but they were divine revelation that was binding for the whole people of God, which eventually winds up in our Bible. So I don't really, you know, I'm not going to pick on Beth Moore here. I don't put a whole lot of stock in somebody like, you know, Beth Moore telling me she's had a vision, but I wouldn't insist that she didn't either. What I want to hear from her is that this was personal. I got a blessing from it. I felt directed in some way. You know, I felt that it was guidance, and I felt like I needed to obey, and I did, and the Lord blessed it. I'm fine with that. Again, because she's not telling me she's a prophet for our time, and she now has information binding on the entire believing community that somehow escaped notice when God produced this thing we call the Bible. Okay, that at that point, I'm just going to tune her out. The Muslim example, as I recall, this was part of the question. I have heard about these things, and you know, there's some YouTube videos of it, and you know, I know people who have not. I know people who've traveled with, you know, certain groups in Muslim countries that, you know, have gone to visit, you know, one or two of the people, you know, who now are pastoring churches, you know, in these places who had such encounters. Again, I don't really have any problem with that either. I mean, if God, you know, or the Lord wants to sort of invade that person's life, and I think a lot of those kind of situations are actually what you see, it sort of mimics what you had in the first century, where you have sort of divine encounter that, you know, steps into a person's life to call them to ministry or to validate the message of the gospel. I mean, we're in the book of Acts. We see this all the time. Again, they're not claiming that I have some new information outside of the Bible that we need to, you know, append it to the Bible. Now I'm God's prophet here now for the believing community everywhere. We have people saying, look, I was a Muslim. I was this, I was that. I was an unbeliever. The Lord showed up and said, basically, repent and believe. You know, I'm the way. And they obey. You know, they go start a church. They put themselves at terrible personal risk to do so. They know, understand the gospel. They know what it is. They preach it. Again, I'm not going to say God couldn't have done that or Jesus couldn't have done that. I think that would be way beyond the line, you know, for me to say. So I'm very open to these sorts of things. Again, I would classify myself sort of as cautiously open, and the cautious part again is I want to know. I want to hear from the person relating this incident to me, this experience. I want to know that they're processing it in such a way that they're not presenting themselves as an apostolic authority. If this is something personal, fine. I can't, again, whip out a verse that would say, God, you shouldn't have done that. Or, you know, God, if you did that, we're going to have to talk about that later because there's this verse over here that, again, that's absurd. God can do what he wants, but when he does act, he's not going to act in a manner contrary to this thing that he invested so many lives in to produce for us that we call scripture. So it's not going to be any sort of contradicting message. You know, by the way, people might be wondering, well, what if you had an experience? I would process it exactly the same way. If I had my own experience, I'd keep it to myself. The Lord already knows because he and I have had these conversations, okay? The Lord already knows I'd need like repetition for me to be convinced of anything, that this just wasn't a random dream or something like that, because I don't know if I could process any experience correctly. And I'm not saying that these things are about intelligence or intuition or anything like this. I'm just being honest with God, honest with the listeners here. If I had some experience tonight, tomorrow, today, you know, whatever, I'm not going to go claim any authority for it because I don't know that I'm processing it correctly. I really don't. I mean, I'd have to be omniscient to know. I would try to discern some personal direction from it, you know, some reason for it. But I wouldn't go out, write a book, and get on Oprah, okay, to promote myself as, you know, some super apostle now or something like that. I'm not going to go, you know, and claim I have, you know, access to divine knowledge. Again, those things are silly. They're absurd. I think they can be really sinister too. So if it was me, I'm just telling you, this is not going to be a shingle I hang out because I don't know if I could process it correctly.
Okay, the next question is from Travis. Can you clarify your view of the timing of the events related to the fallen sons of God? They are not in prison at the time of Babel, clearly, because Psalm 92 references their corrupt administration of the nations.
Yeah, that should be Psalm 82, I think.
Psalm 82.
But go ahead. Sorry, okay. I didn't want to interrupt you.
That's okay. But they are imprisoned by the time of the resurrection. If Christ's descent to proclaim victory references them, does Daniel's, quote, prince of Persia reference indicate that they are not yet in prison by the time of the exile?
Yeah, the question is conflating two different but related things. The original offending sons of God, Genesis 6, were imprisoned in all biblical or Second Temple Jewish traditions that I know of, okay? Second Temple literature, Peter and Jude, of course, presuppose that. So the original offenders in the Genesis 6 incident are imprisoned, you know, the abyss. There are different terms for it, but they're in jail, so to speak, of course. And that's one group. The other group, okay, the sons of God who were allotted to the nations and vice versa, Deuteronomy 32, and of course their judgment is referred to in Psalm 82. That's a different group. These are not the same groups. You get the same terminology. Again, sons of God are used of both, but the sons of God of the Babel event, Deuteronomy 32 worldview, are different sons of God than the ones in Genesis 6. Just because the same title is used doesn't mean we're talking about the same entities. So these are the ones, again, the ones that are set over the nations. These are the ones under eschatological judgment in Psalm 82. They will lose their dominion. Again, something, you know, I place at the day of the Lord, before the consummation of the kingdom in a new earth. The original offenders are apparently released sometime prior to the day of the Lord consummation. I personally think that's the point of Revelation 9, the description of the abyss there and, you know, what's left out of it. And that isn't unique to Revelation 9. You will have other passages in Second Temple literature that talk about the release of, again, the original offending Genesis 6, you know, sons of God. The language there, you know, will vary among texts. It'll say something like they're in the abyss until, you know, the end of the age or the time of the end or something like that. And that's language that specifically relates to the day of the Lord. Again, this sort of final climactic confrontation where, you know, all that's wrong is set right. The righteous are vindicated. That, again, as we know from the New Testament, precipitates, is a precursor to the new heavens and the new earth. And that would make sense because what happens in the new earth, according to the book of Revelation, okay, to him that overcomes, you know, believers who are, again, the reconstituted sons and daughters of God, the reconstituted children of God in the council, the reconstituted council, they are put over the nations. Okay, they displace the corrupt sons of God that were under judgment that have been dealt with at the day of the Lord. Okay, they take their place, you know, under God's, you know, authority, God's rule. So this is part of the sharing of the kingdom between the risen and returned Christ and his people. Again, this is this joint rulership idea, but it actually says they're put over the nations. And again, that language is supposed to take us mentally back to, well, who's over the nations now? Well, it's these guys, you know. And again, this is their eschatological judgment. So to wrap it up, this question, I mean, these are two different groups. So when we conflate them, it creates the kind of confusion that's part and parcel of the way that question was worded. So in the end, all human and divine enemies of God are judged at the day of the Lord, regardless of the chronology of their rebellions. In other words, regardless of when they screwed up, Genesis 6, that's pretty clear. But the corruption of the sons of God over the nations, again, we're just told that they go astray, they seduce the Israelites, whatnot, all this sort of language. We aren't given a very precise chronology of that. It's after the first group, but no matter when they screwed up, no matter when they went into rebellion, a rebellious posture against God, they will be dealt with at the day of the Lord.
The next question is from Carlton. In one of the documents linked in the last Q&A, Belial, Belar, am I saying that right?
Yeah, Devil, all those B Satan words.
Yeah. It gives a date for the writing of Daniel as 167 to 164 BC. This is problematic in that the book itself seems to claim that it should be dated much earlier, somewhere around 600 BC. He wants to know what you believe about the dating of the book. And then he has a follow-up saying that, you know, if it's the former, it's problematic that Jesus would have referred to Daniel as a prophet, as it would seem that much of what is claimed as prophecy would have actually occurred in the past. If it's the latter, what would you make of criticism of the book that claims that it doesn't seem Daniel knew the period well?
Mm-hmm. Well, the 167, 164 BC, let's just say 2nd century BC date for Daniel, that is the dominant view. Most people who hold that view, it's fair to say, would be, you know, theologically liberal. And when I use the L word there, I'm referring to people who would not put any stock in something like predictive prophecy. There are evangelicals who do put stock in predictive prophecy that take the late view, again, the second century BC view. My personal position is I don't really care. And I'll try to unravel why, and then tell the questioner sort of, you know, where I'm at. Broadly speaking, I don't really care because the events of the book, okay, when you read the book, the events of the book, as the book is written, are situated in the 6th century BC, and nobody doubts that. I mean, that's the setting of the book. But that doesn't mean that that's when the book was written. Okay, they're two entirely different things. You know, it's like, you know, you have the same thing going on with the book of Job. People want to make these arguments about how Job predates Moses and the patriarchs and all this stuff. Well, there's no mention of the law, no mention of the covenant, and all, you know, well, so what? If I were writing a book today, I could easily set it in the pre-patriarchal period and avoid those things. But the fact of the matter is I'd be writing it today. And in antiquity, you have the same thing. People were capable of writing books set in different time periods than the one in which they were living. And in Job's case, there's lots of other reasons why the law or the covenant might not be mentioned. It could have been, you know, Job itself is actually set in, it's not set in Canaan. It's in the Transjordan. Okay, that could be a reason because, you know, we're not really living in, you know, the quote-unquote Holy Land proper where the, you know, the rest of the Israelites are. You know, Job is not an Israelite. Okay, he's from the land of Uz. Again, he's Transjordanian. Doesn't mean he's not related to the Israelites because you get Edomites over there, whatnot. I mean, there's all sorts of factors that could explain why the arguments and really undermine the arguments that people use for a book like Job. My whole point in using that as an analogy is, again, you can write a book in one period and situate it in terms of its content in another. That's easy. I could do it now. So on one level, everybody sort of recognizes and agrees on the setting of the book. What they don't agree on, obviously, is when the thing was written. So you have an early date, 6th century BC. Again, that's sort of the traditional traditional date, what people would refer to pejoratively as the pre-critical, you know, date. Anybody who accepts the 6th century date for the date that it was written, you know, can't be thinking critically. Well, that's just ridiculous because there are lots of scholars who do, you know, who take the 6th century date as the date of writing. And then there are other scholars who take the later date, 2nd century BC. Now, this whole debate really focuses on several things. It's not just about predictive prophecy. You know, if you're theologically liberal, you're going to naturally be biased against that. And so you're going to pretty much gravitate toward the late date anyway. But there are other things going on. There are linguistic issues in the book. For instance, in the Aramaic of the book, you will get features, either vocabulary, grammatical points, syntactical points that are typical of late Aramaic, later Aramaic than Imperial Aramaic. Imperial Aramaic would be the period in which the book is set. So you would think if the book was written in that period, in the period in which the events are set, that the Aramaic used would conform to Imperial Aramaic that is known from lots of other material outside the Aramaic portions of the Bible. But that isn't always the case. And in fact, in some cases, it's clearly not. You have late Aramaic features in the book. And so the question arises, well, how did they get there? Does that mean that the book was written later? Because if it was written later, somebody could very easily use old Aramaic because that existed already. You would just sort of look up how to you know, your vocab choice, how would an old Aramaic writer put this, and then you put that into your book, and it makes it look, you know, authentic in terms of if you were trying, you know, again, to convince someone it was written during a certain period, this is what you would do, to give it that flavor. So the style would actually match what the events of the book. I'm not talking about a deception here. I'm talking about technique when you're writing, again, to just give it that older flavor. Is that the way we account for the differences? Well, you know, who knows? You can go either way. There are whole books, there are whole monographs written on the Aramaic of Daniel, comparing the Aramaic of Daniel with Aramaic of other periods. And frankly, the linguistic arguments in both directions have produced a stalemate. There are ways to explain late features and early features in the book. So there are ways to explain late features if you think the book was written early. There are ways to explain early features if you think the book was written late. So it has really gone nowhere. For someone who's interested in this, probably the best survey you could get on this would be either John Collins's more recent Daniel commentary in the Hermeneus series. It goes into this a little bit. Delbert Hiller's in the Anchor. I think it's in the Anchor. No, that's a journal article. Hillers, who was a professor for a number of years at Johns Hopkins, actually wrote a good bit in defense of the Aramaic of the book being situatable in the early date. So I don't know that he actually took the early date, but he has a lot of good work there showing that, hey, you know, the Aramaic itself doesn't invalidate the idea of an early, you know, early composition. So, and you get defenses on both sides, but in my judgment, the whole thing's a stalemate. Another issue is apocalyptic genre. Now, this one to me is actually more substantive than the Aramaic, the linguistic issues. Apocalyptic literature is a known genre and a widely known genre. Now, try to follow what I'm going to say here, because I'm going to try to say this well. If I may goof it up, who knows? We're just winging it here. But apocalyptic genre has to do with, as you would think, as you would suspect, the end times, the end of the world, the end of all things. Okay, within that kind of literature in the ancient world, there are certain features of it, like divine messengers, you know, where angels come and they give someone information about the future. Typically, this angelic message is going to talk about human history being divided into periods, okay, specific periods, and there will be symbols attached to those periods. You know, if you're thinking, well, that kind of sounds like what Daniel's doing, you know, Daniel 2 and Daniel 7. And yeah, it does. The problem is that overwhelmingly, and some would say exclusively, but overwhelmingly, those specific features, angelic mediators, again, the division of periods in history, you know, the dramatic ending where you have sort of cosmic celestial events, you know, that are associated with the end of the world. Overwhelmingly, the examples of that genre are late, second century and later. And so lots of scholars feel compelled to look at Daniel and say, this just fits so well in the second century BC or later that it's sort of a no-brainer. This is where it belongs. This is where it should go. And you have other, you know, apocalyptic, you know, literature is from that period that really builds off Daniel, parallels Daniel in significant ways. That actually introduces a little mini debate. Well, if Daniel was written at the same time with this other person who wrote this other book, would they have had access to Daniel? If it was written early, they certainly would have access to Daniel. But if they're sort of contemporaries, would one guy really, you know, have access to this material so that they could sort of sound alike and look alike and he could borrow from Daniel? And, you know, how would that work? You know, if they only lived like 5-10 years apart from each other, how would that work? Whereas if it was much older, you go to the Library of Alexandria, you're probably going to be able to pull out the Daniel scroll there. I mean, you could access the material a little more easily. At least it seems to make more sense. But in terms of the genre, overwhelmingly, the clear examples of this are late. Now, the problem with that is there's a good bit of material in Daniel related to apocalyptic themes that has its roots in Mesopotamian literature. The Mesopotamian literature is a lot older than the second century BC. So then that raises the question, okay, well, how would the writer have had access to this? Because if he's writing in the second century, where would he get that? He could just go to a library, just go to Babylon, just go to Alexandria. There it is. You know, so that explains that. Well, really, does it? Because what it shows, even if you can make that argument, it shows that the kind of ideas that go into that genre predated the second century BC. And so in theory, at least, it's very possible that the book could have been composed earlier than the second century BC. And again, there are whole books written on this too. So I view the whole Daniel issue as, again, something of a stalemate. Now, before I, you know, sort of land somewhere here, this notion of, well, if it's the early date, or excuse me, if it's the later date, then it's problematic because how could Jesus call Daniel a prophet? And what about Daniel knowing the period well? Well, frankly, lots of people, even conservative evangelicals, have problems with the way Daniel knows the period. And the crux of the matter is Daniel 11. Because if you're a second century dater, everything that Daniel's writing, you acknowledge openly, he's just on the button. Okay, when you get to Daniel 11, it's like, well, he's living at right here at this time, you know, and he screws this up. It just doesn't fit. And they're right. The stuff in Daniel 11 doesn't conform to the stuff that's happening in the second century. And so the critic, you know, who takes the later date and who has no time for predictive prophecy would say something like, ah, Daniel just messed up here. He did a good job, but he messed up. Well, for someone, again, who has a higher view of scripture than that, what do evangelicals typically, and most of these are going to take the early date, what do they do with it? You get to Daniel 11. They're going to say, well, Daniel's prophecy quits tracking on the events intertestamentally and projects into the future period of an antichrist. Now, I'm not saying that, that's an escape valve, but it sort of is. And I'm not saying it's not legitimate, because there are things in Daniel 11 that do point to the future. Namely, Jesus, who lives later than the second century BC, quotes Daniel and says, hey, you know, this abomination of desolation thing and some of this other stuff, you know, this is still yet to happen. So it has to point beyond the second century. But evangelicals sort of get off the hook by saying, well, that right here at Daniel 11, verse 30, now we jumped into the future. You know, we don't have to worry that what Daniel's written here doesn't conform to the history of the second century, because Daniel's talking about something that's, you know, hundreds and thousands of years later. We're off the hook there. You know, a lot of people just don't feel that you should do that. You know, and again, they're going to use that as an argument to argue for a later date. And then they more or less have to say that Daniel messed up. And some of them are quite willing to say that because, again, they don't have any theological predilections against it. But let's back up a little bit. You have Jesus, again, referring to things in Daniel as yet future. That alone, even if it's only Daniel 9, even if it's only one verse, you have the book of Revelation doing it too. So even if it's just Daniel 9, Daniel 11, and a few other things that the book of Revelation alludes to, that alone tells you that there are some portions of Daniel that are yet future. And even if they were fulfilled in the past, there's going to be, you know, some mirroring, you know, some second round of fulfillment come later. Even if you take the late date, even if you're an evangelical, and I know some of these, you know, I have friends who have genuine testimonies. They're real believers. They're not like fake believers, okay? They take the late view of Daniel. Even they have to admit that this doesn't rule out predictive prophecy because of what Jesus said, because of what the book of Revelation did. Okay, it doesn't get predictive prophecy off table for them. They take the second century date because of things like literary genre, that they feel it's just a compelling argument to put Daniel in the second century. But they'll very freely say some of this is still yet future. So, I know this is a long, involved question, but here's the thing. If you meet someone who takes a late view of Daniel, do not assume they're a liberal. Okay, you need to ask them. You need to actually ask them where they're at theologically. Do not assume anything, because you're gonna run into evangelicals that put it in that period for different reasons than you're thinking. Because typically what people get exposed to in church is if anybody who doesn't believe in the 6th century date for the composition, they don't believe in prophecy, they're a liberal. Well, yeah, maybe. It'd be nice to ask them first, because they'll probably tell you. But don't draw that conclusion. Now, again, my opinion here is I think the whole thing is basically argued to a stalemate. I think the best argument for a late date is the genre, but it's not conclusive. And I've tried to explain a little bit why. So I don't really care on one level. I lean to the early date because I don't really see a reason to reject it. I don't see a good reason to reject it. And since I have no problem with predictive prophecy, I'm comfortable there. But, you know, if I woke up tomorrow and somebody discovered something that compels a second century date, now we know. Because it doesn't take predictive prophecy off the table. I should mention one other thing. You know, this whole notion of prophecy after the fact, that also is a known genre. It's called prophecy ex eventu by scholars. Well, you will have books, again, books written in the Second Temple period, where you have the writer who elsewhere in the book, it's pretty clear that they're writing at the time, or they're living at the time they're writing. They write certain things and they cast it as predictive prophecy, something predicted earlier but now happening in their time. Okay, again, that's not quite what we see in Daniel, but there are people who again try to argue for prophecy ex eventu as what's happening in Daniel. But be that as it may, I want to talk about this phenomenon. Here's the way it would work for an evangelical, because again, it is a known genre. So let's just say that tomorrow we wake up and there's something that's discovered that just conclusively says, hey, Daniel was doing this in at least one or two places. Is that a crime? Is that a theological crime? Is it a literary crime? Well, the answer is no, because here's how it works. Here's what would be going on in the person's head. Daniel would be looking around at political events or some other event and say, wow, this stuff that's happening, we're transitioning from one empire to the next. And this is just like what God said would happen. And it's happening now. And so I'm going to write about it, but I'm going to make sure that people know that this was predicted earlier. And so I'm going to write it that way so that people know that, you know, God gets credit for this, you know, for these movements in human history. And so I'm going to write it this way so that they know I'm not, you know, just getting lucky, or I'm not the authority here, but you know, God knew this was going to happen. So I'm going to write it this way, even though I'm living at the time when this stuff is happening right now. Because, you know, I hate to tell you this, but most of the stuff really that's in Daniel is not new. Daniel's not the only one that wrote about the passage of human empires. He's not the only one that wrote about Assyria was going to get their butts kicked, and the Babylonians are going to get their butts kicked, and the Medes and the Persians are going to get their butts kicked. Other prophets write about that, that are contemporary with or earlier than Daniel. Okay, it's not all new original material, and so it's conceivable, at least in theory. Again, I'm not advocating the position, but I'm just saying it's conceivable that this could happen. This actually does happen in other ways in the Bible, when you have a psalm, for instance, like Psalm. I think it's fair to say Psalm 51 might have some of this in it, where it's a psalm of David and you have this allusion to David's, you know, personal sin. But at the end of the psalm, the psalmist says something like, you know, Lord, rebuild the walls of Jerusalem or rebuild the city or something like that. I mean, I don't have it in front of me. But it's a thing that would be appropriate to say well after the time of David. And you say, well, why would the psalmist do that? It doesn't make any sense during the time of David. It's like the exile. It's like, you know, the stuff that's later. Well, like, who wrote the psalm? And what you have happening, and I think Psalm 51 is just a convenient example, is either someone amending the psalm or adding to the end of it or doing something like that, where they're saying, look, just like David sinned and God forgave him after he repented, we as a nation now are in this situation where we are under God's wrath because of our sin. And we, nationally, just like David personally, we are repenting and we're asking God to rebuild the walls of the city. So the psalmist sort of inserts the nation into the psalm and uses David as a springboard, as an analogy for a communal lament, a communal repentance, a communal plea that God would forgive them corporately, just like he forgave David. That you'll actually have, you know, instances in Scripture where material is sort of edited or reworked like this. And that was okay because, in the Jewish mindset, the mindset of the Old Testament people, biblical prophetic voices weren't just the ones that you and I know their names to. Most Old Testament books, in fact, the author isn't even named. The date of the book certainly isn't even given. Okay, there was this sense that God would raise up people and would continue to raise up people who were prophetic voices, who were his official spokespeople, and they would make sure that not only was the older material preserved, but they would keep adding to the material that eventually the community, the community at large, the people of God at large, would deem sacred, would deem canonical, would deem inspired. You have lots of unnamed people in the process of inspiration. This is why I say inspiration is a process. It is not an event. Again, there are indications of this smattered all throughout the text, of deliberate arrangement, deliberate changing this or that so that it conforms now to something else in the canon, okay, where it's the work of not only a grand mind, the mind of God, but of collective minds, the people that God is using. All of this stuff works symbiotically together over the course of time. This is how we got the Bible we got and we have. Again, these aren't just paranormal zapping events and out spits a book of the Bible. That is not the way it happened. So Daniel, this whole prophetic prophecy after the fact, again, you could have some of that happening in Daniel, which is why I say ultimately, I don't really care about the question, but I know why people ask it. They want validity in predictive prophecy. And what I'm saying is evangelicals who take the late date, they know. They understand because of what Jesus says, because of what the book of Revelation does. Even if you take a second century date for Daniel, predictive prophecy is still on the table. It's not on the table in certain passages because they could have been after the fact, but they're still inspired. For them, it's not a reason to deny inspiration at all. For the liberal, they don't really need any other reason to deny inspiration other than the fact that they don't believe God acts. You know, they don't need any scholarly justification. That's just what they think. So they're going to naturally gravitate toward the second century date. It's the one that fits best for them. But there are still going to be evangelicals who will take that. So don't assume anything. Ask some questions before you start calling people a liberal before they deserve it. try not to jump to too many conclusions there.
All right. Our next question is from Joel. What are we to make of the Apostles' Creed? In particular, he's curious about the statement declaring that Christ descended into hell. Where does this information come from? The two contexts he's wondering about are Luke 23, verse 42. Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. In 1 Peter 3, verse 18 and 19, made alive in the spirit in which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison. Mm-hmm. He's also interested in your thoughts just in general about the Apostles' Creed as a whole, and is the Apostles' Creed alien to the context of the Bible?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say the descending into hell language comes from 1 Peter 3. If this person read the old draft of the myth that is true, you'd be able to find it in there. If you have that, you could search through it for, again, an explanation of that. But I think it certainly comes from 1 Peter 3, where Christ descends to the underworld, the realm of the dead. Again, specifically here to the imprisoned spirits associated with the flood, that is the offending sons of God. And I think that is clear. In other words, the spirits of the dead aren't the dead humans killed in the flood because of the Enochian typology that goes, you know, with the whole chapter there in 1 Peter 3. Now, it took so long on the Daniel thing, I'm wondering how far to go into this. But basically, again, if you have the old Methodist True Draft, you could read this. I'm going to try to do this real quickly. 1 Peter 3 is really only decipherable if you understand that Peter is using Enoch, specifically a scene in the book of Enoch, and Enoch the person as his typological referent. Now, what I mean by that is, remember, think of Romans 5. Paul uses Adam as a type of Christ. Okay, type, the word type, typology is something your listeners probably have heard of, but all typology is nonverbal prophecy. You know, we're familiar with prophecy, you know, verbal utterances that prophets go around saying this or that, and they predict things, and, you know, we get that. Typology is nonverbal prophecy, and what that means is that you have an event in the Old Testament or an institution, let's say like Passover, or even a person, something a person does. An event, an institution, a person that prefigures, okay, that prefigures something that will happen later. Okay, it's nonverbal. It's not spelled out in writing. Okay, it's just something associated with a person, an event, a place that prefigures something that's going to come later. That's what a type is. So Paul uses Adam as a type of Christ, an analogy, okay, a precursor analogy to Jesus. Peter does the same thing here with Enoch. Now, that's hard for us to see because we're not familiar with the Enochian literature. Peter was, and so was Jude. We know this from 1 and 2 Peter and Jude. Okay, and there's this whole scene in Enoch where, you know, the patriarchal figure Enoch is with God, and we're not really told, you know, how, but when God decides, you know, he to punish the offending sons of God, he puts them into prison, and the offenders there somehow contact Enoch, and they say, Enoch, you know, God likes you. Will you go talk to God and see if he'll let us out of here? You know, we're sorry. And Enoch says, okay, I'll go do that. And so Enoch goes to God, and if like 1 Enoch 6 through 15 or something, you're going to get the whole story. And they're not long chapters, so I recommend just doing that. But so Enoch goes to God and says, hey, you know, I'm here to speak on behalf of the watchers back there. They're sorry. They know they did wrong. You know, they'd like you to relent a little bit. And God says, forget it. Just go back there and tell them that they're toast. They're going to be there until the time of the end. You know, I'm not rethinking this. This is what they deserve. So Enoch, now catch what I'm saying here. Enoch goes and descends to the underworld, and he goes to the spirits that are in prison in the book of Enoch and says to them, well, God says no. He gives them bad news. He gives them news about, you know, you're going to be here till the time of the end. You're still under wrath. That's just the end of the story. Well, Peter uses that as an analogy to Jesus, you know, a type, precursor, so that when Jesus dies and he goes into the underworld, the realm of the dead. That's where the dead go. They go to the realm of the dead. And he goes and he preaches, speaks to these spirits in prison. Okay. And this is why in 1 Peter 3, you have the flood, you have the angels that sinned, you have the ark, you have the flood narrative connected somehow with Jesus dying and going into the realm of the dead. You know, like, Peter, what in the world are you thinking? Well, here's what he's thinking. Jesus gives them the message this time. And the message, again, we can gather from other parts of the New Testament, other parts of what Peter writes, especially the end of 1 Peter 3, where it has Jesus above all principalities and powers and all this other stuff. Jesus essentially goes to the spirits in prison and says, you all know who I am? You're probably surprised to see me here because it means I'm dead. But guess what? you and your other rebellious colleagues, you know, that are, you know, doing their thing either on the world or in here with you or whatever, you know, think that this was the way to defeat God's plan. Well, guess what? I'm not going to be here very long. I'm going to rise again from the dead, and you'll still be here. You will still be toast. You are still under wrath. You are not getting out of here until God says so. And then you only get out for a short time, then he's going to just destroy you anyway. So it's bad news again. So Peter uses this story from Enoch as a vehicle to talk about the an otherworldly, you know, spirit realm conversation, confrontation between the dead Jesus, who is going to rise again, and those divine beings who at one time had rebelled against his father. Okay, and again, you tie that in with all the other stuff in the unseen realm about if the spirits, the rulers of this world would have known what would be the result, they never would have destroyed, never would have killed the Lord of glory. And all. Again, this is one piece that fits into a much bigger picture in the unseen realm, which is why I wrote the book Unseen Realm. But again, if you don't understand what Peter's thinking, that he's thinking of this story in Enoch, you're never going to be able to decipher what's going on in 1 Peter 3. And the early church understood this. This is why not only do you have this language in the Apostles' Creed, but you also in the early church used to have in baptismal formulas. Remember, 1 Peter 3 is also about baptism. You also have in baptismal formulas renunciation of the devil and his angels to commemorate the content of 1 Peter 3. And we don't do that anymore. This is why I have a whole chapter in the book where I basically say baptism is holy war. That's the meaning of it. That's the symbology behind it, this confrontation. This picking of sides, this choosing of sides, is really, again, what is sort of cloaked in this act of baptism. So the language there, you know, that's where it comes from. The second part of the question about just generally, the Apostles' Creed, by definition, since it's so late, it's after the New Testament era, by definition is not the context that informs the Bible or the biblical material. It can't, because it's later. It's the other way around. The biblical material is what informed the Apostles' Creed. So I don't see anything in the creed itself that is contrary to biblical theology. I mean, some people get bent out of shape over the Catholic Church line in there. This is before we had a Catholic Church. Catholic just means universal. So believers everywhere, it's all the line means. Again, we don't have a Catholic Church until centuries later, you know, after the Apostles' Creed. So it's not an endorsement of Rome or anything like that. So with that caveat, I don't see anything in the creed that's contrary to biblical theology. And I think, really, that's not a surprise, because the Apostles' Creed is really a minimalistic creed. It's very, the points in it are very, they're sort of the highlights of New Testament theology. So I think that's why, again, you don't have anything really in there that's, you can't trace somewhere into the New Testament, including this line.
Okay, our next question is from Seth. He's actually got three questions. First one is, is there any complementary overlap of the warfare worldview as Dr. Boyd teaches and the divine council worldview that you're presenting?
You know, I can't be real precise here. I'm not completely sure how to answer the question because I haven't read God at War. Now, I know Greg, and you know, Greg and I have talked about the divine council several times. He came to hear a couple of my papers at Evangelical Theological Society meetings. So I would imagine that there's a good deal of positive connection, you know, between my book and Greg's. You know, Greg's training is in philosophical theology. That's, you know, what his focus was at Princeton. So he's not going to be familiar with a number of things that would derive, you know, from specific points of exegesis in the context of comparative ancient Near East stuff and Semitics. I mean, that's not where he drilled down in his doctoral work. He was doing something altogether different, again, philosophical theology. So consequently, a lot of what he's doing is primarily with English Bible and then following rabbit trails that journal literature or some other source, you know, might lead him along. And, you know, that's part of the reason why he was interested in coming to, you know, to my papers, was he had come across divine council stuff and, you know, knew it had an ancient Near Eastern context. And so, you know, we had lots to talk about, you know, at the conferences. So I would imagine, again, that's the best word I can use. I would imagine that there's going to be a high degree of workable overlap, you know, between that particular book, or at least that part of the book, you know, and what I'm saying. But I can't really be sure as far as a specific statements, because I haven't read it. Greg has seen, you know, what I just said about his background versus mine. That's not a put down. So I don't want anybody to think that's a put down. Greg has seen more of this stuff than most. Even people who have their PhDs in Old Testament, that like got their PhDs from a seminary somewhere, Boyd is more in tune with certain things they ought to be in tune with than they are, because he's just, you know, read enough outside the normal, at least at the time God at War was written. At least what he was tapping into wasn't the kind of thing you'd run into in evangelical journal literature. Now, that has changed, basically because of stuff I've written in journals, what John Walton has published, not only in journals, but published more widely. You're getting a lot more stuff from Old Testament scholars in the evangelical world that is permeating the literature, so that if Boyd was writing his book today, it would have a lot more detail to it in these respects. So that just is what it is. But as far as what, especially if you take into context with when he wrote it, he's tracking on more things that are important than some Old Testament guys, you know, who just don't get exposed outside their little sort of theological orbit. You know, and Greg is, of course, not afraid to do that. So I think he should be commended for what, you know, what he did in that book, you know, and other things. Now,
Seth doesn't totally buy into open theism, but he does
see
some aspects of it being true as we co-labor, co-create with God through prayer and preaching of the gospel. Can you share some of your thoughts on that?
Yeah, Greg and I, for instance, would agree that foreknowledge doesn't necessitate predestination. But somehow Greg takes that and feels he needs to have God surprised by things, or that he has to redefine omniscience so that God doesn't know all things. But that doesn't make much sense to me. You know, what's the harm in God knowing all things real and possible if neither requires predestination? God can regret things. He can relent, you know, on something he said he was going to do. But that doesn't mean God didn't foreknow it. I mean, there's no necessary connection here. If the fact that God knows something doesn't require it to be predestinated, there's no theological problem with saying God foreknew something that didn't happen and just didn't do it. You know, so I don't know why Greg feels that he has to redefine omniscience or say God is surprised by things. I don't think God is surprised by things at all. You know, and Greg has this whole philosophical argument. Well, you know, like if something that a human's going to do hasn't even popped into the human's mind and it does, you know, how can God know that? Well, how can God know something that you're going to do, you know, 5 years from now? Because Greg will not say that God doesn't foreknow anything that people are going to do. He'll just allow for this sense of God being surprised or not knowing something. Greg's more nuanced than that sort of simplistic kind of, you know, if God is surprised, that means he doesn't know anything in the future. Greg is not going to say that. But he is going to hold the door open for God not knowing certain things. And I just don't see the necessity of it. So if you're going to define open theism by a point like that, you know, yeah, I'm not going to agree with him, but we would agree on the other point, you know. So it just depends, you know, what the statement is. And I don't have any problem with a high view of sovereignty, you know, God invading somebody's life and making something happen. But frankly, you know, I haven't read all of Greg's stuff. I mean, I've listened to a lot of his papers. We've had discussions, you know, I've looked at his blog a few times, and he's told me, he goes, I'm not opposed to God making something happen. Whereas I think a lot of sort of armchair open theists would not expect him to say that. So again, he's somewhere in the middle of the two extremes, but his enemies sort of put him at one extreme and his fans kind of put him at the other. You know, he's actually more nuanced than that, but we're going to have things that we just disagree on. Listeners should know, I don't view Greg as an adversary in all of this stuff or, you know, any of this stuff. I view him as a friend, despite the fact that, you know, I'm not going to buy some things he says about open theism or conclusions he draws from it. I think he asks questions that need to be asked. And, you know, I think that's a good thing.
Okay. Seth also wonders if the systems of thought on providence and free will are similar in amalgamation as the systems of eschatology that you were describing in some earlier podcast, in that they each have some element of truth, but don't fully describe what the scripture holds together in tension. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. It seems that systems sort of gravitate to one side or one aspect of a subject over another, and then they try to seek to explain away the things that they don't want to gravitate to. So I think there's something to that. So while it's true, systems typically try to find a balance or maybe try to make things work. Some people just end up redefining things they don't like so badly and that they don't really resemble plain statements in the text anymore. You know, like, you know, you'll have people who just deny any sense of human freedom at all. Well, they typically do that to defend this position that they prefer. Okay, well, that's just what happens in systems. You know, people like enough about a system that they get married to it mentally or emotionally And then they just have to do whatever it takes to keep the system preserved or to make it work in their head. And I think that's when you just get people that sort of, you know, jump the shark and go off and onto tangents. And it really becomes about the system as opposed to about the text. And I would say even more simply than that, well, feel free to tweak the system. Why do you need to tweak the scripture or deny something that's pretty obvious in scripture just to make your system work? Change the system. Or abandon it, or marry it to a second system. You know, try to look at all of them and pull out what's helpful. You know, and again, I don't have any problem doing that, but I know I've met other people that's just an abominable thought. You know, if I don't affirm this, then Calvin was wrong. Well, so what? He's wrong. You know, he's human. You know, big deal. Who cares? You know. You know, you're not going to get to heaven and meet Calvin someday, and he's going to say, "Hey, thanks for defending me over against, you know, this and that, even though you just destroyed that verse. But I just felt good about the way you defended me." Calvin will probably slap you upside the head and say, "You know, I was wrong there, and you should have recognized it." We just elevate these systems, I think, in some cases to just unreasonable levels. That's just what makes some people tick. You know, what can you do? But I do think, you know, broadly speaking, like the question said, that all the systems, you know, make good observations, and they have things in them that are worth thinking about and wrestling with. And then they latch onto something, and then they make missteps in other places to defend this other thing over here that they really love. And you know, that's just sort of human nature. So I don't think there's anything sinister about it necessarily. I think some people get carried away with it, but I think it's just human nature. It just happens. I think, you know, my own listeners are going to know that, you know, it's my own view that we fundamentally have misunderstood Old Testament election. I think that's part of the problem. New Testament election, I think, needs to be consistent with the Old Testament that I'm saying and suggesting that has been fundamentally misunderstood. And I think New Testament election also needs to be related to remnant theology, which, like it or not, is a sovereign act. But I think these components can be better contextualized and better articulated and then put back together again. You know, that's sort of where I would leave that question.
Well, speaking of remnant theology, our last question's from Greg. In Acts 13, you briefly discussed Old Testament remnant theology and how it fits into the predestination election debate. He would love to hear more on this, the Old Testament idea, not so much how it fits in the New Testament, and also appreciate any resources you could suggest on this topic.
Yeah, there are a couple things that I will make sure Trey has, and Trey will make sure gets up on the website to deal with remnant theology, a couple articles. So you could look for those. I think to sort of try to summarize an answer here, remnant theology in the Old Testament, and sort of broadly speaking, is that God will never, he'll never let his plan for a kingdom die entirely. And therefore, he will never let his people be entirely exterminated by evil. He's not going to let evil win. Even so, as bad as it gets, it's never as bad as that, because God will intervene. He'll intervene when needed, but he won't eradicate evil, because that would mean eradicating humanity. He will not get rid of evil and free will, because then, you know, that's an admission. That would be an admission on God's part that, you know what, this was just a bad idea. You know, God's not going to do that. He is committed to humanity. He loves the idea of humanity. He created humanity like to be like himself, which includes, again, communicable attributes, one of which is freedom. These are, on the surface, these are just the most obvious things theologically in the world that just jump out at you from the text. I think we need to affirm, you know, what's there in the text, and then, you know, come up with our best understanding of how to handle it. And sometimes, you know, people, like I said, just get married to systems, someone's attempt, and then, you know, love it so much that they'll defend it at all costs, even if one of the costs is coherence. But remnant theology, again, is just this idea that God is not going to let this thing die, and if he needs to intervene, he will. And he does that in the Old Testament. Noah, I mean, he doesn't wipe everybody out. He saves Noah. Noah finds grace in the eyes of the Lord. He saves Noah and his family. You know, he does it with his people. He does it with the tribes of Israel. You know, there's 700 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. He uses Obadiah to hide them. He's never going to let the thing die. But he will not, again, erase humanity to get it done. He will not erase the image to get it done. He has chosen to use people, and use people he will. There is no plan B. There is only plan A. And the New Testament, you have God acting to ensure, really consistent with the old, he's going to act to ensure that a remnant of believing Israel, the true Israel, will not be exterminated. You know, that he's not going to forever forget the Jews now, and the Jews can all be exterminated and whatnot. No, that they are going to, they're going to be believers among the tribes of Israel who embrace the Messiah, their Messiah, and become part of the people of God. But there will also be Gentiles. There'll also be people among the nations who are not of the 12 tribes of Israel. And he is going to lay claim to those nations as well as his own through them. He's going to make sure, again, that he's going to preserve a remnant. He's going to make sure that there are people from the nations, you know, who embrace the gospel and you know, that it never dies. You know, it never, there's never a single nation that doesn't have a witness. There's never a single nation that doesn't have God's people in it, infiltrating it to, again, multiply that situation, to take the gospel to every nation, to every corner, you know, of the world and get the job done. You know, if God needs to intervene, he will. He will not let it die. So that's essentially the overarching idea of remnant theology. You know, by just think about what the New Testament is. You have the people of God. It's circumcision neutral. It's the tribes plus the non-tribes. It goes all the way back again. We're trying to restore an Edenic vision, God's rule over the entire planet. And originally there were no nations, there was no Israel, but now there are. But the plan is the same. You know, God is going to win. You know, the whole planet. You know, it's his. There's not going to be this little crack or crevice of it or little portion of it that he does not own at the end. And his vehicle for doing that are believers, they're people. And he's just not going to let it die anywhere at any point.
You made it, Mike. You made it.
To what?
All the questions.
Oh, okay.
You completed them all.
Well, give me a prize there, I guess.
Get a drink of water.
A little longer, you know, for the Daniel question is just really involved. So, you know, what can you do? But
that's okay. I think our listeners would agree. We could just listen to you forever.
Well, I have a little hard time believing that.
All right. Well, good deal. Well, Mike, we have some exciting news to announce.
We've gotten
questions about how to help support you and your efforts further. And so with that, we've created a Patreon account. And for those that don't know what Patreon is, it's just simply a way to give donations, for instance, like the GoFundMe project that Mike did for the Bibliography project. Patreon, and I'll put a link on our nakedbiblepodcast.com website. There'll be a page up there called support. You can click on that and there'll be a link right there to take you straight to our Patreon page, or you can go straight to it by going to patreon.com/nakedbible, and that's patreon.com/nakedbible. And what that allows you to do is give anywhere from $1 a month to as much as you want. And all of that proceeds are going to be going to the efforts of Mike and all his projects. And Mike, do you have anything you'd like to say about what the efforts would be going towards?
Yeah, I mean, people will notice when they go up to the Patreon site, and this is Trey's work, you know, so I'm thankful that he put the effort into doing this. You know, he approached me with the idea and just thought that, you know, this makes sense to do. And I more or less, you know, had a moment of enlightenment where I could agree with him. But, you know, I was sort of especially put over the hump, you know, by the GoFundMe thing, which was just such a dramatic success. In fact, you know, the original GoFundMe campaign to complete the bibliography was $4,500, and we've gotten, you know, over that. And so that worked so well that I've actually gotten a second project rolling. I can say a little bit about that. There's one of the primary resources. It's a lengthy, it's a 300-page monograph on angels in Jewish theology before the rabbinic period, that interacts with a lot of, you know, Second Temple material and also some rabbinic stuff. But it's sort of a scholarly treatment of the whole of all the periods preceding. That's in German. Then it's by Michael Mach, and it's again a scholarly publication. A little pricey, but I have a copy. But it would take me forever to go through that and translate it. So somebody on the blog alerted me months and months ago about something altogether different. That, hey, I'm a native German speaker, and here's where I live, and you know this, you know, just something I saw and stored away. So I asked this guy, hey, would you be willing to read this book out loud, just translate it on the fly in English, and record that into MP3 files so that we would have a translation of this book? And he said, oh yeah, I could do that, you know. And so we sort of mapped out a project, and part of the overage of the Divine Council Bibliography is going to go for for producing a translation of that. So that, you know, there'll be MP3 files I could share with people. I mean, we could take a shot at getting it transcribed. It's not something I would sell. I can't really, you know, sell the transcription. It would cost a lot of money, you know, to get a professional translator to go through not only the MP3 files, but then put it into something that would be publishable. So we're not going to go through that much cost and that much time. But if I can get the audio files to this thing and people will have access to that as a resource, and maybe down the road, you know, we produce a rough transcript of it, sort of an English translation of it, that'd be worth it. So rather than that taking a year of my life, you know, just puttering about that on the side, you know, I know enough German, I could work through it. But here you have a native speaker, you know, where this would be easy. Why not do it? So it's things like that that I'd like. I have a whole list of these sorts of things. They're small projects and big projects. And so in view of the way GoFundMe worked, we thought, you know, hey, if we are able to take donations on the podcast, this is the kind of thing that we can be doing on a fairly regular basis. Now, ultimately, I mean, there's something else in the works that I can't announce yet. It might be another 6 months before I can announce it. But ultimately, what I'm working toward is being able to raise enough money on a regular basis, a monthly basis, where I could hire a full-time assistant or two part-time assistants. I mean, something that is a regular, weekly, hourly commitment at a meaningful level, all the way up to 40 hours, where, you know, I could have somebody doing work, you know, behind the scenes, in terms of research, mapping out other projects or completing other projects or recruiting people to do projects, that we can actually do some of this stuff. Again, I have lots of ideas, lots of things I'd love to do. It'll also free up my time to do, you know, things like I could jump right into a novel. And I mean, I have to make decisions now. What it comes down to, and I'm going to be doing this in, you know, over the next 2 weeks, I'm knocking down a number of little things I've been working on here in June. We're almost in the middle of June, so I have 2 weeks to sort of mop up two or three other things. And so that means, okay, what do I do now? What do I devote my time to now? And I really have two choices. Do I do an Egyptian, you know, hieroglyphics course for Memra, or do I, you know, jump into the research for the third novel? I can't do them both at the same time. So I have to make a choice. And there are other projects I'd like to do that don't even get to the level of choice one or two. Again, I have a whole list of these things, but I have to make choices all the time. Well, if I had somebody that could take some of these things off my plate and just do them, you know, with a little bit of direction here and there for me, more things would get done and I don't have to make choices that really, if I choose one, then all these other things have to wait a year and a half. You know, I don't like doing that. So I'm hoping that people will support the podcast, but, you know, ultimately you're supporting things like that, projects that I'm interested in doing and making accessible to people, either through a book or something that lives on a site for free. I'm hoping people will take the advantage, you know, and support the podcast. And through that, you know, we can work up to a really good monthly amount where I could actually hire somebody full time. So that would be great.
Yeah, I think it's a great way for anybody, especially our listeners to the podcast, enjoys your content. And hopefully we can help grow that listenership and people who are into your content, and by you know, just as little as a dollar a month would go mm-hmm. a long way. And that's a way that somebody can help for sure further your content and supporting what we listen to every week and what we read all these years and getting the mm-hmm. word out there. And if a dollar a month helps, man, that's, I'm all about it.
Yeah. You know, and it is, you've won the argument here, Trey, so I might as well just, you know, say this, but you know, if you have 1,000 people who give you $5 a month, well, that's $5,000 a month. I could go out and hire somebody full time for that. That's a decent living for somebody, or maybe two people, you know, if they wanted to do two part timers. I mean, that you can do it. You know, you can do it for that. You know, if I had 2,000 people give $5 at $10,000 a month, well, I mean, I could do what I do full time, you know, plus hire a research assistant. I mean, it really is just numbers. And it's not, you know, $5 a month is a latte. I don't drink lattes, but I guess that's what a latte is. It's got to be somewhere around there. It's a numbers thing. And if there's enough people out there who wanted to give, you know, $5 on a monthly basis and just sort of forget about it, and it piles up and things get done. I'm blessed, you know, at my job. I love my job. And my job, of course, has let me, you know, do my divine counsel stuff for the last, you know, year and a half. So I mean, it's just been a great time, you know, doing that. And so that was content that I really care about. Lots of people care about that will grow into other things. I mean, that this isn't going to be the end of the road for that as far as, you know, my own job is concerned and my own, if you want to call it a ministry, you know, does, but there are just lots of other things that could get done if we had the funding for it. And it was exciting for me to hire Dino and you know, Melissa to do the bibliography project, which, by the way, that's probably approaching the 2/3 level. Dino is almost done with the what I would call the input component. It's probably by the end of the month he'll be done with that. And then really the tedious task of tagging resources comes in, and that's going to take a while. But he's so far ahead of where I thought it would be when I posted the campaign. I can still scarcely believe it. But I mean, you get people who have the time, they can do the work and they enjoy it, and you can pay them for it. I mean, it was great. I loved writing out, you know, I've written out two checks now to Dino and one to Melissa, and it's like, that's fun. Because to me, it means time. The money means time to me. That's how it translates in my head. Because I have a good job. You know, I don't need this to be my income. So to me, the money means time, and it means paying other people and getting things done that people will find useful and beneficial. So I'm just into it because of the way the other thing has worked so well.
Absolutely. I think we've got a good Naked Bible community building up. So hopefully this is another step into building that community and letting people contribute to this great content. And so they want more of it. So this is a good way to get more of it. And patreon.com/nakedbible is where you can go. Little as a dollar or more. And that's going to evolve over time as we have more ideas on how to use that or whatnot.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, Mike. So what do we have for next week?
Next week, we're going to do Acts 18 and 19. We'll take two chapters again.
Okay. Well, we appreciate you answering all of our questions. And I just want to thank everybody for listening to another episode of the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.